This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our topic today on Keeping the Faith is the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and we're talking by phone with the National Director, Mark Johnson. Mark, can you hear me all right?
I hear you fine, Steve. Thank you.
And you told me earlier that you were hoping to be sitting on your porch there on the Adirondack Mountains. Did that work out, or did the weather conspire against you?
No, it's a beautiful sunset and a quiet evening in the Adirondacks. The skies have cleared. It's blue and perfect.
So you have some personal peace there. The Fellowship of Reconciliation is what, the oldest peace group in the United States?
It's the oldest interfaith multicultural peace organization in the United States, and it was founded just a year earlier in 1914 in England. So certainly one of the earliest in the world, though Gandhi was already out and about preaching nonviolence when FOR was founded.
Now, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, you've been the director for how long now?
About 18 months, a year and a half.
And why did you accept this position? You had many options. What was it about the Fellowship of Reconciliation that appealed to you?
Well, some of them surfaced sort of from the subconscious. In the 1960s, as I was graduating from the College of Worcester, I applied to become a conscientious objector to the war in Vietnam. And one of my sponsors and supportive persons was Nels Faure, who was teaching religion at the College of Worcester at the time. And it became clear more over the time since, but that he had been a conscientious objector in the First World War, a very difficult war to stand in conscientious objection to. But it set me on a path. I then spent 7 years in Beirut, Lebanon, and became involved in the Israeli-Palestinian, Middle East, Lebanese issues, and active in the use of nonviolence and the search for reconciliation there, and through a great part of my life thereafter. About 5 years ago, I was living, 6 years ago, I was living in Chicago, which once upon a time had perhaps a dozen different FOR subchapters, or cells as they were called in that time, but still had 400 registered members of FOR when I was living there. And so along with Ed McManus and Sam Smith and some others in Chicago, we re-energized the as volunteers, the Chicago chapter of FOR. And 6 years later, when I found myself ready for a transition, it happened that the executive's position was open, and Ed had become the president of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, the chief volunteer officer, and encouraged me to apply. I had been spending a lot of time, particularly still in the issues of the Middle East, working with Jewish, Muslim, and Christian young adults, trying to create a cadre in civil society that would be peacemakers, and everything the FOR was doing at that time seemed perfectly aligned with my life to that point, so I applied and was accepted.
For listeners who have no idea what Fellowship of Reconciliation has been over this last 100 years, give us a quick picture.
Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, it was created in England when an English Quaker and a German Lutheran in 1914 saw their countries headed for war and were already in a constructive, reconciled relationship, and they said they would not let the war interfere with that. And out of particularly the historic Peace Church's Peace Witness, early work of the Fellowship of Reconciliation was in support of the right to conscientious objection, conscientious objector's status. So First World War, Second World War, right up through Vietnam, one of the important pieces of work has been to stand in opposition to war in any form and the underlying causes of war, what we might call the military-industrial complex, or as Martin Luther King Jr. said, militarism and racism. Martin Luther King has served as a segue there because in the 30s and 40s and 50s, FOR became increasingly involved in the civil rights movement. And as King was moving into a leadership role, FOR actually delegated two of its staff, in particular, Bayard Rustin and John Swanley. And the first Freedom Rides and the bus boycott in Birmingham and other early work right up through the plans for the Peace March were actually the work of FOR staff in cooperation and in partnership with Martin Luther King Jr.'s work.
So the Fellowship of Reconciliation is not only concerned with peace between nations, but also peace between folks who are in conflict, perhaps over racial issues.
Absolutely. Active often around issues of restorative justice, concerned with the consequences both at the broadest levels in our society and the individual levels for incarceration, particularly the ratios and biases towards African Americans, but more generally in terms of the reconciling opportunity for people to move back into society in a constructive fashion. FOR is also, ever since 1917 really, but since the Cold War, been actively involved in support of civil society or civilian diplomacy. FOR sent some of the first citizen delegations to the Soviet Union during the Cold War, just as now today we send delegations of civilian diplomats to Iran. We have a group of 18 leaving Tuesday of next week, our eighth delegation in the last 3 years. On Friday of last week, we sent a small delegation to Colombia in South America, where we have a resident staff of five who live in support of agrarian or rural farming communities who have committed themselves by covenant to a peace witness, living their lives without being engaged with military, paramilitary, or guerrillas. So both, you're right, both domestically and internationally. It might help listeners to know, Steve, there are 40 chapters of FOR in the United States, 65 other affiliates, and since the 1940s, an umbrella relationship with various denominations, peace fellowships. As early as the 40s, the Lutheran Peace Fellowship, soon thereafter Presbyterian, and then Unitarian, and through the Civil Rights Movement, the Jewish Peace Fellowship, and then still more recently the Muslim Peace Fellowship and the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, all have an associate relationship with the Fellowship of Reconciliation.
When you talk about it being an international movement, you said it started in England, came to the U.S. very shortly afterwards. How many other countries have chapters of the Fellowship of Reconciliation?
The International Fellowship of Reconciliation was founded in 1919, and its headquarters are in Alkmaar in the Netherlands. And there are about 43 or 44 other nations that have chapters. Most of the European nations have chapters that were founded almost, you know, simultaneously with that in North America, German, Austria, French, and now throughout Asia and Latin America and Africa, there are also chapters or branches. Technically, FOR USA, of which I'm the executive director, is a branch of the International Fellowship of Reconciliation.
You mentioned yourself being a conscientious objector to war in Vietnam days. How do you encourage and support people who make that choice today, since there's no draft? How is that an issue?
Well, there are two or three ways that are of interest. One is that we are actively supportive of communities where there is a need for a clear understanding that in the face of recruitment to the military, the U.S. military has ready and full access to schools, and young men still need to register when they turn 18. FOR works to ensure young men that they know, and young women, that they can examine their beliefs around militarism and conscription or in the Army, and they can still begin to create a statement out of their own conscience and life of conscious objection, should conscription ever be enacted again, then they will have positioned themselves to in a, being prepared to respond. We're also continually aware that we have a poverty draft in effect. The military is most successful in bringing young people into service with promises of medical attention and training for careers and educational resources. And those are promises that are not always fully delivered upon. And so we look for truth in recruitment as a part of our active engagement around conscientious objection. And then there are increasingly, as you know, hundreds of young people who find themselves somewhat unwittingly, perhaps, in the service with no right to conscientious objection as, in the sense that they've volunteered for service and only then come to discover, in a sense, the true nature of militarism and warfare. And so we seek, with a number of other organizations, to find ways to support young people as they seek to extract themselves from a relationship in the military. You are probably aware that over the last few years, the path of going to Canada has once again emerged as one way of young people who are home on leave opting not to return to military service. There's another emergent way in which we're involved with the issue of conscientious objection, and that's a part of our relationship with Colombia. We're engaged in Colombia because it's the third or fourth largest recipient of U.S. foreign military aid in the world, after Egypt, Israel, and the investments that we're currently making in Iraq and Afghanistan. Colombia has had a civil war or an internal conflict of some 40 years duration, and then that's mixed in with our longstanding failed war on drugs. So the U.S. military trains military personnel in Colombia and supports the Colombian military as it relates to drug trade and other practices. Well, as I started by saying, the Colombian Constitution has a right to conscientious objection as one of its facets, but there is no legal path to conscientious objection. So in Colombia, throughout the country, mostly in urban areas, young people are trying to create that legal access to a right of conscientious objection. And just as with those agricultural communities that are in San Jose de Patato, where we live in protective accompaniment with the agricultural community, we also provide protective accompaniment to young people involved in trying to create a right to conscientious objection in Colombia. In the fall, we will bring some of those young people to the United States, and they will visit six or seven cities across the United States and remind us as Americans and young people that this is a liberty. It's a part of our rights that have been exercised for almost 100 years, but not equally available everywhere in the world. And so we're working on some educational efforts in that realm.
Let me reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Dr. Mark Johnson, who is the Executive Director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation in the United States. We're talking to him by phone from he's talking to us from the Adirondacks in New York. Let me give the phone numbers for listeners who might like to ask a question or make a comment. Anywhere the program is heard, you may call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station, of course. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, you can access several local lines by punching in 333-9455. We welcome your calls. While we're waiting for callers, Mark, let me ask a hard question. If you care about your country, why wouldn't you want to be involved in its defense?
Well, I think the basic underlying answer is that we have no evidence that we've ever as effectively protected the well-being of people and the future of culture and society through warfare more effectively than we would have and do through pacifism, through nonviolence. Probably the strongest model of the successful use of nonviolence in that fashion was Gandhi in India and the extraction of India from the occupation of the British through nonviolent social change. I think it's an arguably an inherent and powerful premise in a democratic society that the principles would support a nonviolent path to social change. As we increasingly see here this week, we're 2 days away from what the 63rd anniversary of the bombings of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. We've only become technologically more capable of killing more innocent people in the pursuit of whatever political aims nations and stateless actors engage in through the use of violence. It really is a support of liberty and justice and social and economic well-being to address the needs of people through the use of nonviolence that should be and often is understood to be a patriotic response.
Well, let me push just a little bit farther on that because I'm sure some listeners are wondering. The example you gave of the United States use of nuclear weapons against Japan did bring it into that war that seemingly was going on almost forever, and the U.S. was responding to having been attacked. I know there are various questions about whether we sort of wanted that to happen or not, but it maybe helped made some decisions that might have made it more likely. But nevertheless, there are certainly many examples in past history of aggressive countries attacking other countries. Shouldn't those countries who are attacked be able to defend themselves, even if it requires violence, in order to avoid slavery and oppression and all that?
Well, the question of right to is a fairly slippery and interesting question. The question here is really, is it the best alternative?
Okay.
And who wins and who loses under that kind of a construct? I really was touched and struck by Nicholson Baker's latest book, Human Smoke, as he looks back on the Second World War and what led up to the U.S. involvement and the way in which we used the attack on Pearl Harbor as the lever or the trigger point. But as Baker and others show out, that the administration concentrated the U.S. military forces in Pearl Harbor, knowing from its own presence in Japan and China that if it did so, it was likely to create an opportunity for the Japanese to effectively attack. And so the points here are two, that we are so often deceitfully led to believe that there is only one choice, and that those who profit from war are those who make the implements of war, and that if we dedicated the same kind of resources and the same kind of intention to the practices and uses of nonviolence, that we would not be led to that end. We critique nonviolence retrospectively, without ever investing effectively and fully in its prospects in advance. And if we look at the contemporary world, the world in our lifetime, we see many other examples of where there was very relatively nonviolent effective change, whether that was the end of apartheid and the transition in South Africa, the orange and other colored revolutions in Europe, the end of the Cold War and the breakup of the Soviet Union, the case of the Philippines. In our lifetime, all around the world, there are many examples of people who were in the midst of approaching enormous conflict who, in the end, successfully saw a way through and around the use of warfare as the way of resolving that conflict.
In the U.S. currently, we have this war on terror. Is the Fellowship of Reconciliation involved in any way in trying to bring together at least two sides that are at each other's throats in that war?
Well, I haven't had a chance, and maybe you have or others of your readers have, but I saw this week in my email a new 280-page report by the RAND Corporation who suggests that maybe the healthiest thing we could do is to take the word terror out of our definition of this conflict or war. What we've tended to do is to create a climate of fear that intimidates both free speech and creative searches for alternatives. I mentioned that we're about to send our eighth delegation of 20-some people to Iran, and that's even in the face of today's news that this administration, the U.S. government, is arguing that we need to step up sanctions against the Iranians because of their failure to commit in the fashion that the U.S. would like to see them to an end of their development of a nuclear capacity to generate electricity. The use of civilian diplomats is an effort now over the last 3 years to take over 100 Americans to Iran to say that not all Americans understand that an attack on Iran, a military attack, would be a constructive or positive way of resolving our differences, that we believe in dialogue. And we're encouraged that even as the rhetoric remains somewhat belligerent, that on a number of occasions the U.S. has sent diplomats into situations where there is dialogue. Most recently, 2 weeks ago, on the ongoing conversations of Europe and the U.N. on Iran. We're also seeking to support the travel and visitation of Iranians to the United States. Next Labor Day in Seattle, for example, Bumbershoot, their Labor Day cultural festival, will include a Tehran-Seattle graphic artist poster show. And Daniel Smith, one of our recent delegates to Iran, arranged that in each city that we visited, Shiraz and Isfahan and Yazid and Tehran, that we would meet graphic artists. I mean, these cities are beautiful, big, culturally rich, artful, delightful cities, cities where people gather at the tombs of poets into the evening to discuss philosophy and peace and love, to read Hafez and Saadi. And so we were meeting artists who were using language in positive and creative ways. They will send a set of posters. We've collected a set of posters, and Dan will host that event in Seattle. Also growing out of both the Physicians for Social Responsibility and the work of the Mennonites and FOR, we've been able to support visits from Iran by medical doctors who are part of the Society for the Treatment of the Survivors of Chemical Warfare. We should remember that from 1980 to 1988, the Iran-Iraq War was the first use since the World War of poison gas and chemical warfare. And there are tens of thousands of survivors of that conflict, not unlike our increasing population of survivors of our presence in Iraq and Afghanistan, in the military, and probably in that large population of contracted employees who will bring back both stress and chemical reactions to that war that will be a cost to this nation for decades to come. But these survivors of chemical warfare come and also tell the story of why the Iranians have suffered, as we know, Europeans to enormous extents, the Russians in particular in the Second World War, suffered such great losses that there is no wish to move into another conflict, another warfare. So it's at that level, Steve, that we're involved. We We don't pretend to have access to or to work through the powers that be, through people in government positions. We work more around the issues of civilian society, civil society, and civilian diplomacy in creating these conversations.
The phone numbers to call the station to be able to talk live with our guest today, Mark Johnson, the Executive Director of the U.S. Fellowship of Reconciliation in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We'll reach our studio, and our Technical Director, Jason Croft, will welcome you. Elsewhere, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free call. Mark, you mentioned the civilian diplomacy missions to Iran and Colombia. Out of the 40 chapters in the U.S. of the Fellowship of Reconciliation and the 65 affiliates, how do you choose who gets to go, and what training do they get, and what do they actually do?
Let me say one thing before I answer that question, before it slips. I want to say hello to the possible 40 FOR members in Champaign-Urbana who might be listening to our conversation, to the 400 in Chicago, and to encourage people to be aware that on the 6th at 10 a.m. In Hyde Park, there will be an event co-sponsored by FOR and the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists and the AFSC and others in remembrance of Hiroshima. Steve, we have
That will probably be there where the memorial is in Hyde Park at the University of Chicago.
Exactly. Yep.
And I should before we finish the first half of our program, give you an opportunity to tell people how they can learn more about Fellowship of Reconciliation, website information.
Yeah. Well, let me first say that we have about 30,000 members, and through our website and newsletters, we actually reach about 75,000 individuals. Our website is www.forusa.org, forusa.org. And we also have a blog site that is forpeace.net. And there we keep a more active exchange with our membership and others on the Internet.
And tell us about the print newsletter or magazine, really.
The magazine is, again, America's oldest peace journal. It's called Fellowship. It's published 4 times a year, and it's an integral part of our operation from our headquarters in Nyack, New York. And then we also publish twice a year a newsletter called Witness, which does more to share just the internal workings of FOR with our membership. We work, I would guess I'd say, most largely through word of mouth. We understand from our contacts in Iran that only about 500 Americans a year, non-Iranian Americans, receive visas to Iran. So the fact that FOR, over the last 18 months or so, has sent 100 means that we provide access to Iran for maybe 10 to 20% of all Americans who are visiting there. We do go in cooperation with an interfaith cultural center in Iran, and we do travel with the we have to apply through visas, so we're there for the full knowledge of the Iranian government as well. Our websites, our newsletters, our magazine all regularly carry the list of dates of forthcoming trips to Iran, as well as our delegations to Colombia.
So that's how people who subscribe or look at your website can choose to get involved.
Exactly. And we receive probably between 30 and 60 applications for each delegation. One of the things we try to do is to provide as much of a cross-section of the United States as we can. So we try to reserve 4 or 5 slots for people under 30 years of age. The last delegation we sent was interesting in that the co-leader was Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb, one of America's first female Jewish rabbis. And as far as we know in our conversations with the Iranians, the first female rabbi to ever visit Iran. And it was a wonderful experience because we had a chance to meet with the outgoing and the incoming Jewish member of the Majlis. There is each of the faith traditions have representation in the Iranian parliament called the Majlis. And in each city, because of the participation of Lynn and other Jews on that delegation, they were received in synagogues. There are about 30,000 Jews in Iran. It's probably the oldest continuous Jewish population outside of the Middle East. In a lot of ways, of course, the Iranians argue that they're not part of the Middle East. They're not a part of the Arab world, but they have an intimate and integral relationship to that part of the world.
We have a caller waiting on line number one. Let's move to your caller. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Mark Johnson. Go ahead.
Mark, I think it was Radio Free Europe just carried a article that the Iranians are trying to destroy the Azeri culture. So, you know, I know that Russia had combined all of Azerbaijan, and then the United States forced them to give half of Azerbaijan to Iran, and now that Iran is trying to destroy the Azeri culture there in Iran. There was just an article recently about more arrests of Azeris in Iran that were trying to utilize their culture during a wedding. Is that still a major problem of the Iranians trying to destroy the Azeri culture in Iran?
Well, I'm not specifically well enough informed to answer that question, but I think that the basic question is helpful to remind us that Iran is not a perfect culture or a perfect society. And one of the things that we find when we travel in Iran are many different individuals and organizations who are seeking to bring reform to the ways in which people are marginalized or not treated fairly, and some of that is probably by cultural community. Our point in our visits is, though, that is a right and a responsibility of the Iranian people to bring about those reforms and changes that in our country and in our culture we have a history also of marginalizing people, of forcing people to live without the full access to the rights and privileges of the majority population. So there's no question that there are communities. The Baha'i have a challenging and difficult life in Iran, even though the Baha'ism grew out of that part of the world. We know from the president's visit, Ahmadinejad, that they don't have a very open and receptive understanding of relationships, particularly in the character of homosexuality, and that in cultures around the world where there is that kind of a cultural bias, it's harder to address various kinds of both health issues and cultural issues. But as I say, we were impressed that as we traveled in Iran, people who were addressing those issues reminded us that, A, they were there for that purpose, and, B, that they took their responsibility seriously. And under the current circumstances, when their country is surrounded by the armed forces of the most powerful nation in the world, that support for those purposes from Americans just doesn't help. It puts them under suspicion and at risk. So I think that we do need always to be alert in Iran, in Colombia, or anywhere in the world to where populations, for whatever reason, are at risk, threatened, mistreated, and to speak out on behalf of their rights to the extent that we do no harm to those who are already active in that area.
Did you want to follow?
Partly that Americans, we have so de-emphasized history and geography in the United States that Americans don't understand the cultures of the rest of the world. Like, for example, in much of the world, they take off their shoes when they enter the door, or they wash their hands before a meal, or the Indians mix their food with their hand and eat with one hand still. we just don't understand the cultures of the rest of the world. And so because we de-emphasize history and social studies and geography in our schools, I think we're in for major problems down the road until we re-emphasize and Americans understand cultural differences around the world.
Yeah, and that's certainly a part of the justification. We spend a lot of time, as we construct delegations to Iran or Colombia, we spend some weeks in advance of our visit exploring resources that make us more sensitive and aware of the culture. This last issue of National Geographic magazine does a wonderful job for the American audience, the English-speaking world, to remind us of Iran's long and glorious cultural background, going back to the Zoroastrians and the earliest monotheisms and various cultural artifacts. We try when we're there. I estimate that a group of 10 of us there for 12 days probably meets between 600 and 1,000 Iranians, just in the streets, at museums, at art galleries, at restaurants. And often, it's the first time an Iranian has ever met an American. Their view of America is often that they either hear through American overseas radio, like Voice of America, or see on the movie screen, or the admittedly biased way in which the American society and culture is presented in foreign press. But
thank you.
But we have to do a great deal ourselves to be alert to their culture and learn to celebrate it with them as well.
Thank you for the call. Appreciate it. And we have another caller waiting on line number two. You're on Keeping the Faith with Dr. Mark Johnson.
Yes, thank you. Have you done any studies or have any opinions about reconciling the Palestinian-Israeli situation?
Yeah, first, personally, I've probably had my longest professional and personal association in the Israel-Palestine arena. I did my conscientious objection service and lived for 7 years in Lebanon, and then for many years went back and forth. The first thing to say is that there are FOR chapters in Palestine and FOR members in Israel. And I personally am aware that there are 40 or 50 different organizations in a community of maybe 250 or 280 not-for-profits that are committed to a resolution, conflict transformation, a resolution of the conflict there in people-to-people work, in reconciling efforts. FOR itself, about 4 years ago, just as the second intifada started, created a program called the Interfaith Peace Builders Program, IFPB. In a reorientation of our work and resources, about 2 years ago, the Interfaith Peace Builders, IFPB.org, became an independent, autonomous group. It's housed in Washington, D.C. I think currently its 25th or 26th delegation is visiting Israel-Palestine. So as often as 6 or 8, maybe even 10 times a year, there are opportunities for delegations there. So IFPB was a fiscal sponsor, was fiscally sponsored by FOR, and continues to be supported by FOR in the Israel-Palestine context.
Let me take another moment to reintroduce our guest. We're just a bit past halfway through our program. Mark Johnson has a PhD in sociology from Columbia. Do I remember, Mark?
That's right, Columbia.
Columbia. And he's the executive director for the Fellowship of Reconciliation in the U.S., part of the International Fellowship of Reconciliation. The U.S. has about 30,000 members, he tells us, and many others who read the check out the website or receive the quarterly fellowship quarterly from Fellowship of Reconciliation. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Coming up next week, we'll be talking here on the air live Sunday night from 5 to 6 with Professor Mohammed Khalil from the University of Illinois Department of Religious Studies about Islam. Professor Khalil has been on the faculty for a couple of years now, and we're pleased to have him as a guest on the program. On August 17, our guest will be Bill Timaeus, who has been a religion columnist for the Kansas City Star and also has a blog called Faith Matters. On August 24th, and for several weeks, I will be, my wife and I will be traveling, celebrating my retirement from as director of the Y, and we'll be traveling. But Don Nolan, a professor of religion and philosophy at Parkland College, will be our guest host here, and his guest will be State Senator Mike Frericks and perhaps someone else from the local Democratic Party, talking about the Democrats and value voters. That'll be August 24. So look forward to those programs coming up here on Keeping the Faith. We are always eager to have listeners call in, and again, the number's 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Support for Keeping the Faith is provided in part by the University YMCA. And I might just mention that after my retirement, the interim director there on Wright Street will be Willard Broom, former Associate Dean of Students at the University of Illinois for his entire career, really. He's retired from the university and able to step in and help out the Y at this time. One of the big Y programs is coming up, of course, as school starts. We're still collecting for Dump and Run. We'll be receiving things at the Stock Pavilion at the university on Pennsylvania Avenue, 1402 West Pennsylvania Avenue, just right across the street from the cemetery and down Pennsylvania Avenue from the Memorial Stadium. But at the Stock Pavilion starting Wednesday, August 13, and from 9 to 6, and all that week, Wednesday through Friday, 9 to 6, we'll be collecting things. Particularly, we need furniture to help household goods, to help new students who are coming in get started up, particularly international students. Saturday, August 16, we'll be collecting from 9 till 12, and then Monday the 18th from noon till 8 p.m. to let people come in after work, if that helps. And our last day of collecting things will be Tuesday, August 19, from 9 to 4. And then the huge sale starts Saturday at 8 in the morning, August 23rd. There'll be a $2 admission fee, and as you know, that first day, if you've ever been, it's a wonderful event with hundreds, even thousands of people coming through the Stock Pavilion. It's a huge place, so there's room for everybody, and a lot of chance to buy bargains, and particularly we encourage students, international students, to come and fix up their rooms and apartments. It's a three-day sale. Saturday, there's a $2 admission. Sunday, from noon to 6, it's free. On Monday, from 11 till 2, is a $3 bag sale. Load up anything you can get for $3. And then everything is free from 2:30 to 4, whatever is left. So the real bargain hunters know to come back on Monday and get things that are absolutely free after 2:30. We do give other nonprofits a chance to come in on Monday also. So if you have questions, call Becca Guyette at the University Y, 337-1500, or her email is Becca, B-E-C-C-A, at universityymca.org. If you have more questions, check out our website, universityymca. .org. So, let's get back to our guest, Mark Johnson. Mark, you mentioned earlier protective accompaniment is something that Fellowship of Reconciliation encourages people to be involved in. What is that?
Well, protective accompaniment is a practice that is exercised by a number of peace organizations, FOR, Peace Brigades International, Christian Peace Witness, Presbyterian Peace Fellowship, and in a number of places around the world, actively currently with Nonviolent Peace Force, for example, in Sri Lanka. In our case, protective accompaniment means a young adult, generally a college graduate with full fluency in Spanish and an interest in global peace and social justice issues, goes through a training process and an application process, and then commits to spending a year in Colombia. In northwestern Colombia, in the province or state of San Jose, There are a set of seven villages. The central one is San Jose del Partado, in which about 1,200 families have stated and posted on their property that they are have a peace witness, a commitment to peace, that they will not engage in, they will not support, they will not house either Colombian military soldiers or paramilitary or those from the guerrillas. As a result of that stance, they end up too often as pawns in a conflict amongst others. The greatest threat in recent years has been that those who give greatest leadership to those communities, and perhaps a few dozen have been murdered in the course of their leadership, and then represented as having been supportive of one of the other factions, typically killed by the military or the paramilitary extrajudicially. So what FOR has done is to place young people in the village, particularly San Jose de Partado, but also La Union and three or other villages that the community is moving back into. And whenever the leader of the village needs to travel outside of the village, for example, if they're working on a banana contract or a cocoa contract and need to go to Medellin, that our staff will travel with them on public transportation and otherwise be present in the village. And so the purpose is simply to make it known that were there any extrajudicial attack or problem, that there would be an American presence who would relay those facts to the proper authorities. Just this year, eight former military members have been indicted for some of the killings over the last few years based on data collected through interviews and just the witness of those practices. But they say we have four young adults, one Canadian, three Americans, who are in the midst of service as protective accompaniers in Colombia. We've just finished a five-day training at our headquarters in NIAC with four more prospects who will move into those roles in the next year.
Mark, this is a totally unfair question because I've only read one article about it. I can't even remember where I read it, but it seems like there was an interesting idea. It was the thought of, instead of thinking of a just war, if there is going to be a war, to think of just policing as an alternative, since it's hard to imagine how war can be fair, just, holy, whatever. But using some kind of police tactics rather than military tactics in order to restrain people who are violent and nations who are violent. Have you run across that notion at all?
Yeah, in a number of ways, Steve. I was just reading the Catholic Peace Fellowship's website, and they have a new publication out, the Catholic Peace Fellowship. Paul Griffith in particular has been writing on the inability to find finally any theological or logical basis for a just war theory, particularly as we think of it in terms of global issues like Iran and Afghanistan. But, you know, we can really bring that question right back home. The recent disturbances in New York City around the shooting of Sean Bell, a young man who was sort of caught in a crossfire of both misunderstandings and hard firearms, lifted up the idea in many minds that the work that needed to be done in New York was to teach policemen tactics of nonviolent constraint of emerging conflict. We go all the way back to Gandhi in 1911 and the birth of Satyagraha. The use of nonviolence, the techniques of nonviolence are as accessible to and as important to peacekeeping forces as they are to civilians and peace organizations. I think that certainly UN peace forces have the prospect of being present in a way that mitigates or controls violence when they use nonviolent tactics, and that those services, you know, they're frequently delivered to a community through pastoral leadership of local churches, through social service agencies. We actually house another program that was born at the Fellowship of Reconciliation, but that stands on its own now, called Creative Response to Conflict. And its biggest work right now is actually in schools and youth organizations addressing the issue of bullying. So, you know, you can start very much at sort of the one-to-one level and then aggregate that kind of thinking to state and nation and international work, that there is clearly, we are human beings. We do find ourselves with differences of opinion, with conflicts. We do find ourselves confronting evil and injustice. And one of the ways of confronting that is both by speaking truth to power, by lifting up and pointing to those kinds of ills and evils, but the other is by being prepared to address them nonviolently. I was just reading some essays by A.J. Mustey, who served for 13 years as the head of the Fellowship of Reconciliation and was involved in some of those textile strikes in the 20s in Massachusetts, in Lawrence, Massachusetts. And he talked about how he was able to bring the workers to walk past the mill, which had been reinforced by the police with machine guns, in a smiling and waving and happy fashion. Not unlike those days during the Vietnam era when some of us put flowers in the guns of the National Guard, or not unlike the person in Tiananmen Square who stood in front of the tanks and said, the tank will go no further. That is just policing in a way. It is being present with a nonviolent force in the service of justice.
In a week where the U.S. Supreme Court struck down laws limiting the use of ownership and carrying of handguns in many municipalities, what does FOR have any position on arms?
Well, as you can imagine, sort of the catalog or the taxonomy of issues of violence is sort of deep and wide. Fellowship Magazine is one of the ways in which issues like the right to bear arms and the violence that arises from arms, the presence of arms, again, from handguns to anti-ballistic missiles and atomic weapons, is treated regularly. Certainly our position is that arms beget the use of arms, and that we're all better off when there is no presence of armaments.
Let's mention again where people can get information about the Fellowship of Reconciliation, of which Dr. Mark Johnson is the head in the United States. www.forusa.org is the website for the Fellowship of Reconciliation, forusa.org, and forpeace, PEACE.net, is a active blog. And the Fellowship Quarterly, how much does it cost to subscribe to that, Mark?
It's $35.
$35 a year for four issues.
It's interesting, Steve, that membership in the Fellowship of Reconciliation has always been an act of conscience, not an act of the wallet. Our statement of purpose is a bold statement in terms of standing against all use of war and in support of economic and social justice, standing in the tradition of Martin Luther King and Gandhi in terms of facing militarism, materialism, and racism. But it is simply a commitment to a statement of purpose, and that's available on those sites. We do live, as all not-for-profits do, on contributed support. Our budget of $1.8 million includes over $1 million of contributed support annually, so we welcome donations and support. And then the only defined threshold is the subscription to Fellowship Magazine, which is $35, the first $35 of a contribution.
So people can be members even if they cannot afford to contribute.
And they can contribute even if they're not ready to be members.
I understand. We're down to our last couple minutes. What have I not known enough to ask about the Fellowship of Reconciliation?
Well, the thing I think I would like to be clear about is that we have four basic program areas: our task force on Latin America and the Caribbean, our offices are in Oakland, California, and that's the group that supports our work in Colombia, and we have one staff member in Bogota. Our work around the issues of conscription and conscientious objection is called Youth and Militarism, and our staff for that program are located in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And then our communications department, which publishes our magazine and maintains our website and blog site, is staffed out of both Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and downstate New York. And then our Iran program is housed in our national headquarters, but staffed from Albany, New York. So those are our principal, most intensive areas of activity. But we do have continuing and historic interest and staff engagement in interfaith dialogue. We're currently in support of the Olive Branch Interfaith Peace Partnership, a site for a continuing dialogue amongst faith traditions, especially in response to the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and in caution against Iran. And we do maintain relationships around issues of nuclear armaments and the use of torture and general training in nonviolent means.
We are at the end of our time. I want to thank our guest by phone, Mark Johnson, as well as our callers. Mark is the executive director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, Interfaith and Intercultural Peace Movement in this country and I think he said 43 other countries. So thank you for being on the program today. Remind listeners that next week our guest will be Professor Mohammed Khalil, talking about Islam. He's a professor at the University of Illinois in the Department of Religion, and Bill Timaeus will be our guest the following week, August 17. Reminder that the Dumped Run collections for in Champaign-Urbana for the University YMCA's big sale are Wednesday, August 13 through Tuesday, August 19, and the sale itself starts August 23rd, 24th, and 25th. That's a Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. If you've never seen the Wise Dump and Run program, it's a great recycling effort, keeps things out of the trash, helps people find bargains, and encourages people to recycle so that others may use things that still have value. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the executive director of the Y, and I'm happy to have been host of this program. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Salman Rushdie's new novel is called The Enchantress of Florence. There are stories tucked inside stories tucked inside stories along the lines of Scheherazade. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, Salman Rushdie talks about the Enchantress of Florence as we explore postmodernism. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7. A heat advisory is in effect beginning tomorrow at noon for the entire WILL severe weather coverage area. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly clear with a low in the upper 60s and southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, hot and humid, sunny with the high in the mid-90s and south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Heat indices 98 to 103.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Strategic Capital, Champaign, your area IGA food stores, Birch Tree Counseling and Consulting, Champaign, and Swire's Land and Management Company, Danville. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
You're listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Adults don't understand anymore what